Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started now. My name is Ed Stetzer, that's S-T-E-T-Z-E-R, and I am the Executive Director of Lifeway Research here in Nashville, Tennessee, an evangelical research firm. I'll be beginning and moderating the call. Let's share a few things about who's on the call. Well, first, let me say that we have Kay Warren from Saddleback Church. We also have Jared Pingleton from Focus on the Family. Pingleton is P-I-N-G-L-E-T-O-N. And we want to greet those of you who have joined us as guests and media, and hopefully we can give some helpful information as we seek to speak out and present both research and personal kind of observations on this important issue. For a little background, Focus on the Family was a co-sponsor of the study. And the study deals with mental illness and how the church is responding to such. And you can find more information at the Focus on the Family website at thrivingpastor.com/mental health. If you are in a media outlet and do not yet have the full study, if you'd like to email, we can immediately get that to you. We have somebody standing by at researchteam@lifeway.com. That's researchteam@lifeway.com. The embargo is now, the data is now effectively lifted for those who have requested it. It's effectively lifted, and you can also find that research now posted at lifewayresearch.com. Furthermore, an audio file will be made available after the call concludes. It'll be made available at lifewayresearch.com as well. The structure of the call will be that I will present for a few minutes an overview of the data. There's much more that can be found, of course, in your media kit or also at lifewayresearch.com. Then Kay Warren will share a bit just for personal observations and experience of how the church is doing in regards to engaging and ministering to persons who struggle with mental illness. And we'll hear from Jared Pingleton, who heads up the counseling area for Focused on the Family, and he'll share some of what they're doing and what kind of, as he's seen and worked through, looked at the data, what are some implications that we might want to consider moving forward. Let me share a bit about the data first and the context of such. Why would we even have such a conversation? Why does mental health and the church tie together? Other than the fact that there are people in the church, and if you use the widely cited statistic, about 1 in 4 people each year struggle with some issues related to mental health. If that's the case, then of course 1 in 4 people would struggle in a church. But what's probably more important for this conversation is not the 1 in 4 number, but the disproportionate connection that is found when people are seeking help for mental illness, that they often go to a pastor, a priest, a rabbi, a religious leader in their community. And as a matter of fact, in the mental health crises, it's often said that the most frequent responders are pastors or the police in the mental health crises. And of course, police in many, not all, but in many jurisdictions receive training in how to deal with and how to refer persons who are struggling, particularly in a mental health crisis. And so we think this is an important issue for the church, and our desire is at Lifeway Research is we serve churches in through research. And so let me share some of the results. Now, it probably, as a purist in research, I want to give you all of the methodology, but I think you will probably prefer to find that available online. But just high level, we have 3 surveys we're drawing from. One is a survey of 1,000 Protestant pastors, and the reality is that there are different structures and other denominational traditions that preclude surveying in the same way. So this is 1,000 Protestant pastors, a priest, a minister, a senior leader of a Protestant congregation, a survey of 355 Protestants who had been diagnosed with a mental illness. We talked some about the methodology of how we found those using self-identification as part of that process, and then 207 family members as well, who were diagnosed with acute mental illness. Kind of the high-end findings, the picture that we saw might be described as that talking about mental illness still appears to be taboo among many pastors. When we specifically look at the numbers, here's what we find. 66% of the pastors in our survey indicate that they speak about mental illness once a year or less. And actually, when you break it down, most of that 66% is actually rarely or never. And yet, if 66% speak about it rarely, once a year, rarely or never, yet people who both indicate that they've struggled with mental illness and family members, both at a strong majority, would desire their churches to speak more on the subject. They want their church. It's actually 65% among the family of a person with mental illness, 65% would desire to hear the church speak more on the issue, and perhaps largely because they're only speaking once a year or less. And also among those who are struggling with mental illness, about 59% would indicate that they would desire the church to speak more on the subject. So one of the things we talk a lot about in this research and the conversations we've had, and you can find this in the methodology, we've talked to many mental health experts, and the stigma. The stigma is still felt, is still real inside the church. Perhaps the perception that everyone in the church is supposed to have things together, when I think that's kind of not the desire or the intent of the church. But the stigma still remains, and the stigma still is problematic in congregations. And the destigmatization still is a work in progress. Now, when it comes to churches, though, in churches, sermons break stigmas. And so the necessity is for pastors and church leaders to speak more frequently on this issue. A few other 30,000 foot look pieces of data. There is often discussion, sometimes in certain segments of the Christian church, perhaps particularly among evangelicals, which the three of us on this call would be a part of the evangelical tradition, that there is anti-science, anti-psychology, anti-medication perception. When we surveyed the 1,000 pastors, we actually found that about 40% said that medication should be used anytime when they can ease symptoms of acute mental illness. Medication should be used in moderation was 47% of the time. So those two together made up 87% of the respondents. So I would say that the anti-medication mentality was not as widespread as many, including me, would assume we found. The actual medication should never be used was actually 0%, and we round to, and so it was actually 0.3%, but just a small handful of people sort of had that approach. Actually, psychological therapy was trended actually a little bit worse, and you can see that more fully in the data. But again, a couple of other things. What we find is when we ask the pastors what they do currently, by far the only factor that made a majority was maintain a list of experts to refer people to. That was 68%, so more than 2/3 said that. Most of the rest were in the much smaller minorities. For example, 27% said they had a plan for supporting families of the mentally ill, and you can find all this, of course, on the data. Some have a counselor on staff. That's particularly in larger churches. But what's of note, I think, is when you compare the answers of the pastors, where, for example, 68% said that they maintain a list of experts and 27% had a plan for supporting the families, when you compare that to the answers from the family members, only 28% of them believe that the church maintained a list of experts to refer people to. So, of course, you would assume that they would have a greater level of awareness than the average congregant. And furthermore, 21% said they had a plan to support family members of the mentally ill. So there's a disconnect here we find between perhaps pastors' perceptions and, in this case, congregants who struggle and family members who struggle with mental illness. Now, again, there's much more in the data, and I'll allow you to kind of shape the questions, those of you who are listening on the call. But I'd like to hear less from me moving forward and more from Kay and Jared. So, of course, many of you are very familiar with Rick and Kay Warren's journey. Kay and I actually just spoke together at a conference in Texas called the Peace of Mind Conference. One small bit of information, the conference was planning on 300, had 900 people show up, because there's a great interest in this issue among people of faith, and Kay was the keynote speaker at the event. I shared some pre-release data there as well. So Kay, would you share a little bit with us about why you think this is important and what churches might think or do or pastors might consider kind of moving forward to more effectively minister to persons with mental illness and their families?
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share. As Ed said, most of you or many of you may know our story and our personal connection to mental illness. Just, you know, briefly, 11 years ago, God called me to be an advocate for people living with HIV and AIDS and orphans, and I've been a passionate advocate in these years, but I didn't have a personal connection to, I was not HIV positive, I was not an orphan, I hadn't adopted, but I was passionate. But when it comes to mental illness, this is as personal as it can get. When our son struggled from the time he was a toddler, really, with mental illness that just increased, got worse through the years, became more problematic, more dominated his life and our family, and then culminated with him taking his life last April. It just can't get any more personal than to lose our child to this terrible scourge. And so we didn't ask really to be on this journey, but this is where we are, and we've just decided we're going to honor our son and try to help other families and other churches perhaps not go through what we went through, or at least find better help. So it comes from such a deep personal place in us. In this year, I've heard from thousands of families, people who are living on the edge, people whose loved ones are living on the edge. And while it doesn't have the rigor of the scientific approach, it's more anecdotal, but I have heard through Facebook and email and text and letters and calls thousands of stories. And they all confirm, it's like I'm hearing the same story just over and over and over. You change the names, the cities, but the stories have so many similarities. And they're stories of extreme pain and suffering, of loss, of hopelessness, of confusion, of running into roadblock after roadblock, trying to get help for their loved ones, the individuals themselves who suffer from an illness, trying to access help from churches, from the medical community, from community support, and coming up short time after time. And while I don't have a lot of sway in what goes on in the public arena, I feel like that God has given us a platform of things that we can say to the church. One of the studies that the there was a study that came out last year. It's the National Suicide Prevention Strategy, and it's about 150 pages. And one of the things it talks in there that was specifically about suicide but relates to mental illness as a whole was that there are layers of protection that can cushion the blows of mental illness, if you would, in a person's life. And those layers of protection include things like community acceptance, you know, safe and supportive school and community environments, being connected to other individuals, to family, to social institutions like a church, access to care. And as you see, a social connection, one of those would be the church. And so the church actually can provide a layer of protection to those who are struggling with mental illness to the point that it becomes one of those factors that can keep someone alive, keep them from taking their lives if they are appropriately connected. So that says to me that the church has a vital role to play. The church community has something to contribute to this conversation that's different than what the mental health community might add. It's different than what the government might add in terms of legislation. It's a unique role that the church has. Going back to, churches and are the ones that started, Christians started hospitals and mental health care and psychiatric wards. And the church has a historic role. It has a biblical role. Jesus is our example. God starts by telling all through the Word of what a God of compassion and how he aches and he hurts and for his children when they suffer. And Jesus modeled deep compassion to those that were vulnerable and those that were perceived to have mental and physical and even demonic influences. God models it through the Word, and then Jesus by example, and the Holy Spirit's our comforter. So the Trinity is a perfect picture of how we respond to vulnerable people, and His church, His body, has got to be leading the way. Sometimes people think because Saddleback is a large church, well, of course we can offer a tremendous amount of support to people struggling with mental illness. But I would say it's the role of the church. Whether you're 10 people or 1,000 or 10,000, there are things that every church can do. Every single church can have an attitude of caring. Every single church can offer compassion, to have an atmosphere of compassion to people who struggle rather than ostracizing them or pushing them away or saying, you know, go get yourself together and then come back. But every church can offer compassion and support. Every church can help in times of crisis. If that is something as simple as taking a meal, at the conference that Ed referenced the other day, we heard Amy Simpson, who's written a great book called Troubled Minds, and has lived with a mother who has schizophrenia. And so this is personal for her as well. She said, many times we call it the no casserole illness. You know, when I had cancer, people beat our door down to offer us casseroles and offer us practical help. Well, mental illness is an illness, and we can offer practical help. So compassion, practical help in times of crisis. Every church, no matter their size, can unleash volunteers to be a part of a ministry. Probably the most powerful thing we can do is remove the stigma. It is not a sin to be sick. It's not a sin to be sick. And when we can remove the stigma so that people can come to church with their whole selves. In fact, that's the next thing I would say, is that we can champion a holistic approach to health, to talk about the spiritual aspects, the emotional, the physical, so that we're not just dealing with our souls, but our bodies and our minds. Make it a safe place to be and to embrace every person who has a mental illness as part of the body of Christ, who has a valuable contribution to make. I see frequently those who are moved to try to begin to help. I'd love to move them one step farther. They might come in with, I want to help, but there tends to be a bit of a us and them. Well, they're the sick ones, and I'm the well one, and therefore I'm in a little bit of maybe a more superior place, instead of understanding that people with mental illness just want to be normal. They want to be normal. They want to be like everybody else. They have longings for relationships and friendship and connectedness. And the body of Christ excels at this. This is what we are. We are a koinonia. We are a fellowship. And to include and to embrace people with mental illness, not as our project, not as something that we can take on and perhaps do something for, but fully integrate them into the body of Christ so that they are received as equal members and with something to contribute. There's always hope. Ed mentioned that one of the things that breaks, and I'll conclude with this, one of the things that he mentioned that breaks stigma in a church is a sermon. Highly concur with that. And I would add something else that perhaps is even in an adjunct to that can be even maybe more powerful is a testimony. When we hear the stories of real people who are living with mental illness, how God is there for them, what their struggles are, we see them as real people, not as other, but we see them as part of us. So I would encourage any pastor or church leader, yes, preach a message, but put in front of your people those who are living with mental illness so they can share their stories and become human in that process.
Excellent. Okay, before we move on to Jared in just a second, let me remind everybody that you can email questions to researchteam@lifeway.com. We've already had several come in, but you can email to researchteam@lifeway.com. One question that's already come in related to 4K, had Rick talked about, or you either, talked about mental illness from the pulpit during Matthew's illness? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Not his mental illness, but mental illness in general.
Correct. Well, I would say that I shared very openly about Matthew because he was different from the other children that we had from a very early age. And so I talked about ADHD, I talked about depression, I talked about panic disorder, the things that he had, and even early onset bipolar, which turned out to be a wrong diagnosis, but we were talking about it. And as he grew into teenage years, I realized that it was awkward. It was embarrassing for his personal life to be shared so openly. So I began to put it in more general terms and talked about it generally as opposed to, well, I have a family member. Even when I wrote Choose Joy, I talked about even put it another arm's length away. I said, you know, an extended family member who was struggling with mental illness, because at that point he was an adult and it was his story and he needed to have his own privacy. So there is a bit of a dance. And Rick has talked about it in messages, prayed publicly for people with mental illness. But there is that dance of honoring the privacy of those we love and at the same time being open as we can about the struggle.
Excellent. Good. Jared Pingleton is a clinical psychologist, an author, and a minister. He's a director of Focus on the Family's Counseling Department, which partnered with Lifeway Research and another research supporter to underwrite this study. Prior to coming to Focus, he founded and directed the Relationship Center Missouri. And Jared, if you wouldn't mind, share with us a little bit about why Focus is interested in this topic and some information about what you're doing and perhaps some implications you saw in the research.
Be glad to, Ed. Thanks for having me on today as a guest. I'm so appreciative that this research was commissioned to help enlighten us as to the prevalence and the depth of and magnitude of pain that people suffer in. You know, 37 years of clinical experience, I've witnessed all day, every day, the reality of people that hurt and struggle, and yet also, in addition to the pain that they're suffering inside that is very private and personal, there is then the public shame and stigma to which you and Kay have already alluded very well that I think absolutely needs to be eradicated. And so at Focus, we want to come alongside and we want to be an arm of the church. We want to be not just another parachurch ministry, but we want to educate and encourage and equip the church in very real and practical and tangible ways. One of the practical ways in which we do that every day is in our department, in the counseling center, we reach out typically to 150 to 200 people per day who contact us with their concerns that they want a consultation and counseling services rendered for. And what we have found in the last couple of weeks, we have aired some broadcasts that really touch on people's deep pain, and we have seen our call volume set all-time records, including last week. We did a two-day broadcast on the 18th and 19th, last Thursday and Friday, on dealing with the church and mental health issues, and a couple of psychiatrists on our Physicians Resource Council and myself addressed major mental illness concerns. And again, the response has been overwhelming as people have shared their hurt and their pain and their shame and their stigma as well in their suffering. And so we want to eradicate that shame and stigma. We want to compassionately come alongside churches and pastors and leaders to be able to inform them and educate them as to how they can minister more effectively. And, you know, one of the things I really feel strongly about is, as a pastor as well, I know that the average pastor in seminary and Bible school is not educated or equipped about how to respond to their parishioners' mental health needs and concerns. And Ed, as you correctly pointed out, and as the research attests to, that pastors are typically the first person that someone who is hurting comes to for help. And so we want to help them understand what they can do. And we, as a result, in addition to these broadcasts that we aired last week at focusonthefamily.com or at thrivingpastor.com, folks that are listening can reach out for free resources. There is a pastor's guide that can be downloaded that walks a pastor through, okay, how do I respond? How do I help? How do I come alongside my parishioner who is hurting? And so we, in this guide, we give them not only an overview of what major depression is like, what bipolar disorder is like, what schizophrenia and other major mental diseases are like, but we also give them very practical tools and tips about how to make a referral to a trusted Christian colleague that can have clinical expertise, that is a licensed mental health professional, a physician who can, as appropriate, administer medication and really be able to provide practical help for that pastor. There's also a kind of decision tree as to how to respond if a person comes to you individually or if you hear about a person in your congregation through someone else. Just various kinds of, again, overviews is how that pastor can be equipped and educated and encouraged to reach out to the hurting. As I think about the church historically, I think we have in the past couple of generations progressively done a better job of reaching out, but we still have a long way to go. I know that when I began my practice, it was considered that, you know, if you just pray harder or read the Bible more or somehow get the sin out of your life as if that's humanly possible, then you won't have any problems. And I know that sort of thinking has diminished significantly, fortunately, but it still persists to some degree. And the good news is the research is showing that it is much, much less than it used to be. But I think as we can normalize and humanize mental illness as a part of being human, and as the church hopefully progressively becomes more of a hospital for sinners as opposed to a museum for saints, then what we can do, as Kay was pointing out, I think so well, is hopefully we can make it safe for people to be real, for people to be transparent, for people to share that testimony, which is so humanizing and normalizing to the rest of the church. Because, you know, there's a lot of folks in the congregation, in that sanctuary or that gymnasium or that meeting room or wherever it is that the congregants are gathered on a weekend to look at, okay, how can we help? And I think that kind of normalization is what we need to be able to give good news about to people who are hurting.
Very good. Jared, a question for you comes in from Deborah Browser from Medscape Medical News. What would you say as you look to the data and other studies, I'll add, what maybe is the number one takeaway for clinicians, and what's your recommendation for them, for the clinicians on the other side?
Great question, Deborah. I think what's important for clinicians is to reach out in a collegial, non-threatening way to pastors, to say, I'm available for consultation. I would love to be able to, be a resource for you when you have questions, when you have need of referral, so that there can be a cooperative kind of sharing in the ministry with differing gifts that a clinician can say, hey, I'm here for you to help you, either to encourage you as you're working with a parishioner or to be available for that referral as needed.
Excellent. Good. Thank you. Kay, a question came in for you. What are churches missing out on by not addressing mental illness and ministering to those with mental illness?
Well, first of all, that makes it sound like there's only, you know, that only a few people out there, and so maybe some churches, just to draw the parallel for me, just all the work that I've done as an advocate for people with HIV, there are, you know, around 33 million people worldwide who have HIV. Well, there are 60 million Americans alone who struggle with mental illness. So by the time you do the numbers and do the math, which I'm not a math person, but as I can do that little bit of math, that tells me that somebody in the United States and then has at least four other people in their family, so you're pretty well talking about every American in some way either has some kind of a mental illness in a year or knows somebody or loves somebody. So the people that are being that are doing the pastoral calls every single day in a church of every single size, is they're receiving calls from people who are in mental health crisis. Most of the people who are calling for pastoral care in some way or another are affected by mental illness. So it's not as though this is an add-on. This is not like, well, let's make a decision to care about people who have mental illness. This is who is making up your pastoral care calls almost every single day already. So really what I'm begging churches and pastoral leaders and church leaders to understand is this is who you're talking to every single day. So let's help you get better equipped in doing and handling those calls, helping the people who are calling in terrible crisis. So it's not a matter of, you know, well, maybe this will come your way occasionally and you can choose to do it or not. No, this is where you're at. So let us help you figure out how to do a better job of walking alongside the people who are in crisis, what they need, what the church can offer, and it will not only improve the lives of the individuals who call, but it makes the church richer as well.
Good. Jared, a question for you, but I'd also like to ask Kay to respond to it as well. It's from Adele Banks from the Religion News Service. It says, two questions. How recently have resources been available? And that's, I think, a question specifically to Jared. But then the next question or related to it is, and do they not recommend using a secular professional as opposed to a Christian one? And my comment when you mentioned, you know, finding a Christian to kind of refer to. So let's talk first, the first question, and this be specific just to Jared. How recently have the resources been available that you're speaking about?
As far as our resources at Focus, we have progressively been developing those over the years. And I think really in the last generation, we're seeing that there is more availability of healthy resources. And so to me, the good news is that we're making incredible progress and inroads in getting the truth out in a healthy and helpful way. So in short, I think progressively more and more and more those resources are out there. The reason why I believe that it's very important for a pastor to have a trusted colleague who can come alongside them as an analog or an adjunct to their ministry is because of worldview issues and just a philosophical approach of looking at life and how it is that one's faith is integrated. I think many times because, 100 years or so, and maybe even 120 years back, there was such a mutual antagonism between folks that were coming from a science base and folks coming from a spiritual base, that antagonism has lingered in many respects into and throughout many in secular psychology and psychiatry, such that there's not only been a lack of collegiality and mutual support and respect and understanding, there in some quarters has been downright animosity or hostility one way or the other or even mutually. And so I think in terms of trust and safety issues, to me it's very vital for the good of that parishioner that both share the same worldview so that the pastor knows that they can refer a member of their flock, one of their sheep, to someone who will not, as it were, fleece them and will not only derogate or denigrate their values, but will support and encourage them with their values.
Very good. Of course, we didn't ask that specific question in the research, and so, but Kay, I'd like you to maybe kind of weigh in on that issue. Is how do you find partners, perhaps in your own journey, or how would you recommend others to find partners that can come alongside as colleagues with church leaders to assist those who are struggling with mental illness?
I might have a slightly different perspective. I agree to a large part, but in my own experience, I can, you know, I have my own experience to refer to, and as I said, that of thousands of other folks. The ideal would be to find a Christian psychiatrist, psychologist who can, marriage and family therapist, someone when you're looking for a professional who can augment what a pastor is going to be speaking on or teaching on in their church. That worldview is very critical. I completely agree with that. It's just not in my experience that that's always available.
Sure.
So I can't say I wouldn't go outside of a Christian, because I would and I have. And in fact, the best psychiatrist that we found was someone who was not, I didn't know at the time, was a believer. I've come to find out, I think, is. But the point is, if I'm going to get my heart worked on, I don't really care if the cardiac surgeon is a believer or not. I want the best. And so I have a slightly different perspective on it, and one of the ways that I, although I would agree with the ideal, but there aren't even enough psychiatrists and psychologists as it is. There's a lack of them. There's a lack in that professional community. There just simply aren't enough to go around, and to find a Christian one in a small town who's also excellent may be quite a stretch. There's one resource I would say that is available in almost every community in the United States, and it's the number 211. And the number 211, similar to 411, if you dial it, you'll get information generally about, you know, you're calling a restaurant or you need a business. But if you call 211, it's set up to help people find mental health resources in their community, many which will be free, some will be at low cost. At least it gives people a starting point if they don't even know where to begin, or if their pastor or their church leader doesn't have a recommendation for them. They can at least start with that and know that it's going to connect them with county resources, city resources for their loved one or themselves who's struggling with a mental health issue.
Excellent. One of the additional questions directed towards Kay. Before I get there, let me remind everyone that they can send their questions to researchteam@lifeway.com. All the data is now available at lifewayresearch.com as well. One of the questions came in just for clarification, Jared, is, and I've got the information here, but I introduced you as doctor. Are you a medical doctor or doctor of psychology? It's a PA, a doctor of psychology and clinical psychology, for clarification. Okay. The question for you is, why do you feel pastors, actually they say for you and me, but I'll have you answer first, why do you feel pastors have been hesitant to speak about mental illness from the pulpit?
That's such a great question, because if we could tease out the answer to that, we could probably do a better job. I think it's a misunderstanding about faith and faith matters. I think that may even have come up in your survey, which you can speak to. But I think that there's a misunderstanding that to talk about the mind, there's a confusion over whether mental illness is real, whether every problem is not somehow ultimately spiritual, and therefore, if it's ultimately spiritual, why would we even consider it? It's either demonic, or it's a lack of faith in a person, or it's a lack of discipleship in a person. So I think there's a misunderstanding. I think there's also fear. I think we fear things that are confusing or difficult, and sometimes people's mental illness becomes so severe that it can, you know, it twists families into pretzels. And so a pastor who may not have received very much, if any, counseling background while he was in seminary or took no seminary or whatever, it just feels so ill-equipped. So it seems like perhaps it's a misunderstanding of mental illness as a real illness. I think it can be fear. I think it can be the confusion that somehow it's spiritual and not physical in nature, and then just simply being overwhelmed with so many things to care about in a church on a daily basis, that to spend much time learning about mental illness can maybe just seem daunting or out of reach.
I'll add, since it was directed at me as well, I think there is a sense that perhaps many Christians, and I think this is why it's important that this conversation is a survey of people who are connected and involved in churches, many people of faith are unsure where mental health fits into the kind of the descriptive categories. You know, there's illness, we know, we have cancer, we know that there's oncologists. We have spiritual struggles, we know that we can turn to, and there's pastoral care. And so sometimes pastors seem unsure of where this fits on the continuum. And what I would say is that we need to recognize that Christians, it's not, well, we'll turn this over to, we'll outsource this, we'll abdicate our responsibility, the church no longer should be involved, or the faith no longer should be involved. The way we'd put it in the Christian world is, you know, the gospel no longer has bearing on this issue, but it does. And I think the question is just to think discerningly about how it does. But I think partly that pastors, you know, a friend who actually, one of the scholars who we consulted on this project is David Murray. His book is Christians Get Depressed Too. David's field is in a different field, a seminary professor, but he's written extensively on this issue. But what is fascinating is that you had to write a book with the title Christians Get Depressed Too. Yet it appeared necessary. And by the way, I should add that David would be a good source if you wanted to follow up with some others who've written on the subject as well. So I do think, again, one of the follow-up questions was about my question of sermons break stigmas. And I just think that talking about these things, you know, if a quarter of your church in a given year was going to struggle with a bout with cancer, you'd have a month-long series every year on dealing with cancer. And I'm not saying you need a month-long series on dealing with mental illness every year, but I am saying that a greater awareness of the prevalence will lead to a greater communication of the challenges. And I think we need that. I think we're in a situation now where we just have people asking questions. And it's a moment in many ways, Kay and Rick and Matthew have kind of brought to the conversation, which actually leads to our next question. And please, Kay, go ahead.
Could I add something? Do we have time for me to just add something right there?
Oh, yeah, you certainly do. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, good. Something I thought of when you were speaking as to probably another factor of why pastors are don't talk about it that much, and it goes back to that misunderstanding. I think that we have in our minds, when you say the word mental illness, I think for a lot of folks today, they think of someone who is either catatonic, who is either drooling all over themselves, who is brandishing a weapon in a mall or a theater or a school. We think of violence. We think of people who are catatonic. We think of people who are homeless on the street talking to the fire hydrant. We have a picture in our mind of someone who is severely ill, and we lump anyone who might have a mental illness into that pot. And that's unfortunate because, as I understand it, I'm not a professional, but as I understand it, mental illness falls on a continuum. And all of us have, to some degree or the other, usually anxiety or periods of depression or periods where we don't really know what to do, or might have be debilitated by a fear of spiders. I mean, I'm pulling stuff out of the hat here, but the idea is there's a continuum, and you really, we get fearful to use that term and think, if somebody says, I'm struggling with depression, oh my goodness, does that mean I've got to be hospitalized? Does that mean that I am no longer sane? And so it becomes this fearful thing of nobody wants to be thought of as having a mental illness, let alone a pastor. And so to talk about when does depression that you might feel as a result of losing a job, when does that depression that's, you know, situational, it happened in because something very directly happened in your life, and feeling depressed is a very normal reaction. When does it move from this is normal to, oh, no, this is something that is abnormal and it's affecting your life in a negative way? But because we don't tend to see it on a continuum, but just as these pictures of severely mentally ill people, I think that gets in the way.
Excellent point.
I'm not a professional, but that's just what I observe.
Yeah. Well, as a professional, if I may jump in here, Kay, that is extremely well put. I believe you just hit the nail on the head. That explains the shame and the stigma and the fear that people have that somehow, oh my goodness, you know, I'm going to be seen or thought of in this way or that drastic way. And you're absolutely right. Every one of us is human. And if we can understand in a compassionate and caring way the hurt and the struggle that we all experience, if we made the church a safe place to be human, again, a place where we can be transparent as a hospital instead of a museum, if you will, where, you know, everybody feels like they have to be perfect, that would, I think, greatly, greatly normalize things. And one other piece that to me is very, very important in this regard, on that continuum to which you spoke, I think that's so important. Is this, to me, a basic difference between healthy people, couples, families, and churches, and unhealthy ones is simply this. Healthy people, couples, families, and churches can talk about their feelings. Unhealthy ones can't, and they act out their feelings. So I think being able to talk about it, which is why sermons and testimonials are so vital psychologically and relationally, is that, wow, I can relate to that person. Yes, they're hurting. Yes, this has been a big grief experience they've gone through. And they're hurting. You know, I think the labels are another thing that cause us to really shrink away from embracing the pain of our fellow humanness, of someone who's hurting. Is, you know, we have all these pejorative labels that are so horrible. But yet, if somebody has diabetes, you know, we don't shame them. We don't stigmatize them.
Okay, I want to try to get as many questions as we can. So so let me go to Bonnie Pritchett from the Texan. And her question is, part of the church care problem seems to involve a lack of communication. Some people don't want to share their problems and subsequent needs on many issues. How does a church and or individual church member provide support if the individual family does not make the need known? And so let me throw that to Kay first. So what about those who are maybe secretive, perhaps because of the stigma? How can we help those who perhaps we might see from the outside or not sure? How can we help them?
Well, the bottom line answer is to remove the stigma. And when the stigma is removed, then people will feel more confident, feel more safe in explaining or sharing what's going on in their lives. It's very difficult to share the deepest hurts of your heart, of what's going on in your family, if you feel like that when you share it, you're going to be met with either, well, just read the Bible more, pray more, memorize a few more verses, or someone who's going to speculate on the hidden sin in your life, or who's going to turn away from you in either fear or rejection. Who wants to share? Not many of us are brave enough to boldly say what's going on in our families if you feel that that may be the response. So this is where pastors and churches have to take the lead. It's just rare that a family is going to come with the stuff that's going on in their lives if they're not sure of how they're going to be met. So the pastor starts preaching. If there's awareness that there's a Celebrate Recovery program in the church, if there's awareness that there's a support group for people with mental illness, or there's a little blurb in the bulletin that says, if you're not sure, if you're struggling and you need some help, here's a resource to go to. Just all the ways, the overt ways that we can talk about mental illness, put it into the conversations of church, pray, even if the pastor stood and at the prayer time of the church service and said in the prayer, God, today we lift our congregation to you. There are people here hurting. There are folks struggling with cancer. There are people who have a mental illness. There are people hanging on by a fingernail. God, make us a receptive, a warm place where every single person feels that they can share. I mean, a prayer says, it communicates to a congregant, somebody here gets that mental illness even exists, and if I were to bring it up, they're not going to push me away. So small ways that we can begin to dispel the stigma.
Very good. Jared, a question for you from Carol Pipes, Facts and Trends Magazine. What are some of the signs? Are there signs pastors can look for to spot suicide risks? We've just come out of National Suicide Prevention Week. I'm sure this has been things you've discussed before. So quickly help us know some of those signs.
Well, that's a very astute question. Suicide is a national epidemic, and you know we realize that it's a very intensely private thing that, you know, again, we don't talk about much. But the truth is that 40,000 people ended their own life in the year 2013, and so it's the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. In the United States, every 13 minutes, someone takes their own life. So how do we predict behavior? Well, it's the hardest thing there is to do for human behavior is to be able to predict how it is someone may choose to behave, particularly in this kind of an ultimate sense. But there are some fairly generalized warning signs to which we can be aware, and some of those factors are that, you know, many times a person may talk about wanting to kill themselves or saying that they wish they were dead or they're not sure how they can live or they're not sure why anyone else wants them to live. Obviously, more direct indicators would be when there is discussion or talk of a plan or behavior that would perhaps be potentially lethal, like hoarding medication or purchasing a gun, talking about a specific suicidal plan. But in general, when we see someone who is hopeless, who is being socially isolated, who perhaps has symptoms of major depression, such as their sleep is distorted in one way or another. They're sleeping too little or not enough. They're losing interest in things. They're withdrawing from pleasurable activities. They're isolating themselves from relationship. They are withdrawing from friends and family and others. Maybe if they're acting irritable or agitated, enraged a lot, all of those kinds of symptoms or indicators are warning signs that we need to take very, very seriously.
Very good. A question for you, Kay, from Christine Scheller, who's a well-known religion reporter, freelance, and one of my favorite because she's an Oxford, fundamentalist. But talk to us a little bit about the 211, the system. And her question specifically was, is that available nationally? I wasn't quite sure if you were saying it's available nationally.
Yes.
And what are other resources there are as well? Go ahead. Okay.
It is available nationally. It's the United Way and some other organizations have funded, and it is available in almost every community in the United States. It's expanded rapidly over the last few years. 211 connects people. There are live people at the other end, and they help connect folks to, for instance, if you've got an addiction or there's a suicide, someone you feel someone's going to take their life, or you need mental health counseling or lower cost medication. It's got just about every resource that would relate to mental health. So it's like a phone tree, if you will. Once you get in it, it can help you move from area to area to area. It's a great resource. It's something I'd not heard of. It wasn't even available a few years ago, but it's it is available almost nationwide. I'm sorry, what was the other part of the question?
And just in general, these kind of phone call lines, just kind of, if you wouldn't mind just comment generally on it appears like you obviously are a fan of its effectiveness.
Well, I know as a parent who struggled many times, and I had resources. We had financial resources. We were some of the blessed ones, the lucky ones. We had enough financial resources to get the help that we needed, and even with that, we didn't often know where to go. A family practitioner, which is where sometimes people will go after they've gone to the, you know, police or the their pastor, if they're looking for help, they'll start with their family practice doctor, who may or may not really know all that much. And so they just don't know where to go. Where do you go if your loved one is schizophrenic and is on the street? What do you do? What do you do if your child? It's even harder to find resources for children who are struggling with mental illness. So, and pastors, I'm sorry to say, don't usually know all that much themselves about where to send somebody. So 211 can be an invaluable resource to at least get you started into figuring out, what do I do for my loved one who is in such terrible struggle?
Excellent. We have just a few minutes left, and so let me remind you that that if you email any questions, it's to researchteam@lifeway.com. We'll try to get any on. We're trying to do somewhat fast answers, but we'll do just a couple more and kind of go from there. One of the questions is about referring people, and one of the things that we found in our research was that 59% of pastors who counseled one or more people who are eventually diagnosed with an acute mental illness. So it appears that pastors have some connection to referrals that have led to a subsequent diagnosis. So the question is, and Jared, again, we need to be brief, though, what are some signs that you need to refer to somebody? Now, it doesn't mean I give away the person. You're still in ministry and connection. What are some signs you need to refer to bring in some trusted colleagues who can help?
Great question. I wish there were a short, slick answer. I don't know of one. In general, when you're feeling a sense of powerlessness or helplessness, uncertainty as to how to proceed, it may be that the person is very close to you socially, such that the boundaries would be very difficult to maintain, even if you were qualified and confident in your ability to help them. They're too close to you, so you would need to refer in that circumstance. I think just generally when otherwise, other than someone that's very close to you, which is very common in a congregation, particularly a smaller one, is when you're in a situation for which you're not trained or experienced or equipped.
Excellent. Okay, follow-up question for you. to the degree that you're comfortable, how did you balance the internal congregation caring and showing the the love that's there and from in a Christian fellowship and community to and with outside professionals?
For Matthew, is that
for Matthew?
Is that,
yes,
I think I understand the question. Well, we're fortunate, had great youth leaders and children's leaders who loved on him and were so accepting and caring. He couldn't have asked for a more loving group of adult leaders throughout his life. So very blessed by that. But his problems were so severe. They affected school. They affected social life. They affected every single aspect, every domain of his life was affected by his mental illness as it increased. And so it just became clear that caring, loving adults didn't have enough. His situation, it would just be like you've referred to cancer. It'd be at some point he needed something beyond somebody just loving on him. So that was not really hard to figure out pretty soon that he needed also professional help. One of the things I just slip back in really fast is that churches can offer support groups. On the folks on the family site, they talk about Mental Health Grace Alliance, which is a great organization that helps train churches to do support groups for those who are mentally ill and their families. Larger churches can probably do something that smaller churches can't, but that is to train lay people, because there is a role that lay people can offer on lower level psychological and spiritual problems. We have a 30-week training at Saddleback for lay counselors, and they did, I'm going to exaggerate and say it was like, no, it's not an exaggeration, it was like 3,000 lay counseling hours last year by our 300-plus lay counselors. And this is something that's available at Saddleback Church, that we can train other churches to train their lay people to do some of this wonderful counseling that is trained people, but they're not professionals. And sometimes that's really all people need. They need to be listened to. They need their hand held. They need somebody to pray with them. They need somebody to walk them through some stuff. And then at some point, then they know to refer beyond that if their problems are greater than that.
Excellent. An excellent place to end our conversation and our call today. I want to thank both Kay and Jared for their participation, and for those who called in and asked questions and others who listened in. Again, the embargo is lifted on the data. You can find the full research available at liferayresearch.com. Also, resources for the church available at thrivingpastor.com/mentalhealth. Many of you are already aware of what Rick and Kay Warren are doing, though certainly, again, worth being reminded of their engagement on issues of mental health. You can find more information at kwarren.com about what Kay and their family are doing and engaged with. So, again, thank you for taking the time to be with us, and we'll wrap up the call at this point. Again, thank you for your time. Bye-bye.